Hi, I'm Pete Lega. Thanks for coming this afternoon to hear us. Pete Lega, Jason Victor from Merck Pharmaceutical Company. I've been around Usenix. We were just talking with our introduction person about, I've been around Usenix since 1987. I was part of the face server work. I was a DEC, I'm an OS middleware web kind of person. I pivoted into health science about 12 years ago as a newbie in that space. And one of the things I like most about being there is that we're working on technology at scale for sort of a different purpose other than technology, specifically health and wellness. And that draws a lot of the people that we work with into this space because it's a little bit of a higher calling, and it's sort of neat to see how much we can take technology and make it do something for people we know, people around us. And with that, Jason?
Oh. And hi, I'm Jason Victor. I've been at Merck for 15 years and came in, I'm currently an architect, but I came in as a developer and also worked on many support projects as well. And currently we own the DevOps strategy for Merck. So speaking of Merck, have you guys heard of Merck before, like number of hands? All right, oh, cool, all right, great. So as you know, Merck has been around for a while time. Yeah? Was it? Not the Darmstadt, that's right. We're known as MSD outside of US and Canada.
Be very clear about that.
Very clear. It's a top five pharma in the world. It's 125 years old, and it is regulated. And we'll go into more details of what that means. Now, we work in a group within Merck called Applied Technologies. And that's an innovation and invention group that spans IT and sets up platforms for the company as well. So we'll talk more there. And we're driving DevOps today to enable our business to move quicker with technology. So let's get started. So here's what we'll review today in our story. We'll talk about the opportunity and the challenges we had in implementing DevOps at Merck, and go over our approach, including our tool chain and the cultural shifts that happened along the journey. All right, with that, let's get started. Pete?
Okay, so first of all, regulated industries, right? How many people here work in a regulated industry? Wow, awesome. I feel a lot better because I was expecting like one hand. So as some of you know, the question was, why are Teslas like chickens, right? And it's not because they might have ludicrous mode or, but they could actually both kill you if they're not handled or served or used properly. Regulatory processes basically are there to keep society, you and society, safe. As you got here to this conference, you took a car, plane, or train. You might be looking up your portfolio and you feel fairly confident that it's in good hands, at least from a transactional point of view. You ate your lunch, which you didn't know where the food came from. You don't know the ancestry of the food or the provenance of the food. You don't know how it was prepared, but you have a degree of confidence that as you ate it, you're going to be all right because there's processes and regulations in place that keep it safe. You could do this yourself, and small groups can do this themselves easily and maybe not need as much regulation. But when you're talking about doing it at scale, it's a whole different proposition. And especially when things are going right, great. When things go wrong or things get out of whack, it's those same regulatory processes that gives you a coherent, quick way to deal with them. Nothing's perfect. Even astronauts, they're always looking for the next thing that might hurt them. Not because they want it, but they have to be prepared. So to have processes in place that can manage things at grand scale, global scale, are very important. In our business, in writing code and delivering technology for health science, just to give you a sense, this doesn't apply to all our systems. We have a parking lot locator, which may not apply to, but in general, when we're working with regulated data, a simple one-line null release, one line of code changing or something, that has to go through a process, perhaps in our manufacturing plant or research areas, could take days of wet signatures, five or six approvers from different areas of interest. Everything that's touched is validated, signed off, recorded, logged. double checked, rechecked, input qualified, output qualified, before it ever touches a production system, and then it's even watched even more, with more scrutiny. So you can see it, regulatory does put a burden on, but for good reason. A mistake, you know, could be catastrophic either in a health perspective or in a business perspective. If some sort of issue occurs in this kind of environment, you could stop research. And they may have to backtrack. It may invalidate research, which is, you know, horrific. You could stop a production line of manufacturing of a vital vaccine. And you probably read that vaccines are in shortage in some areas. So stopping a line is you know, pretty serious. Or you could be kept from marketing in a given, you know, a market, a country, an area, because of something that was spotted. Similarly, it may not be because of a mistake. It may just be that something was revealed that your process was wrong, so therefore your process is not trustable. Everything's working fine at first glance, but, you know, the process suddenly needs to be put into question. So there's a lot of scrutiny for a lot of good reason, and that makes it harder than just building a social platform or some other things that are interesting, valuable, and make money, but there's this new dimension to it when you're dealing with regulatory. So what we're going to talk about today is, you know, how do you move quick in this type of environment with technology? And there's a perfect storm brewing of, which I'll talk about, that gives us a unique opportunity for the reason of why we want to do this.
It's a good idea.
So if you look at the three fronts of this perfect storm, the first one is the raw material of innovation and invention, the data and the methods. It's where the science is digitized. The science itself relies on discovery, analysis, iteration at great scale by many people with a lot of failing fast and, you know, seeing what works, what doesn't work. And traditionally, that data source was big monolithic data stores. As you know, big data is all about longitudinal data, big, wide, diverse sets that are being joined. And that's growing and growing and growing. IoT data is one example where we're collecting it probably by the megabytes per minute in this conference off of Fitbits and whatever. And now even dishwashers, baby cams, you know, we're generating a lot of environmental data that ultimately might be useful in a health context. Finally, we're digitizing a lot of historical information. You know, we look back at publications, scientific data, of things that were put into the market going back, you know, decades to see if there's insights on how we build things new. So that digitization is adding tons and tons of data into the mix. And finally, open data. As you might have heard Joe Biden talking about the cancer moonshot, he's actually talking about releasing open data to the public, anonymized, to allow crowdsourcing and researchers to work together on, you know, accelerating cancer research, and that could be applied to other diseases. Other companies like ours are modeling our business around working more and more with other parties and working with longitudinal data and working with open data, because it gives us more data, more insight. This clearly wasn't happening 5 years ago. It's a tsunami compared to where we were then. Next is technology. And, you know, IT data centers were focused on servers, PCs, networking, tools, databases, sort of the underlying support. Now technology is being used with big data tooling, machine learning, cognitive, that it becomes part of the invention. It's where the discoveries are starting to happen. IT and computer science is taking a higher place in the food chain of adding value to the company and to the science. And what's interesting is what we're learning is the same tooling for DevOps that encourages collaboration, provides transparency, that makes DevOps work, actually is starting to get picked up by data scientists, researchers, even manufacturing and sales to do their work quicker and to provide more easy transparency as they do their work. The same patterns are applied. So the burden on the technology areas is actually to start supporting them too. And finally, talent and culture. Everything here hinges on human capital and the culture that goes around it. The long-term employee is now being replaced by workers that work agile, not just on code, but they literally cycle their careers 2-3 years, learn, collaborate, publish, and then they move on to the next job and share, collaborate. And when you're dealing with long-term research and long-term technology initiatives, that turnover is something you have to accommodate for. Knowledge transfer is no longer just write it up and hand it to the next guy. It's a whole different thing. And that puts a burden on what we need to do as technologists, but with for a really good reason. It enables our ability to move very quickly and buy back precious time in these health science cycles.
And this is all about buying precious time. In the pharma industry, did you know that it takes upwards of 14 years for a pill to go from an idea into a medicine cabinet somewhere, right? And what's worse is that out of the tens of thousands of potential candidates that go in this at the bottom of this kind of process timeline here, you're lucky if you get one at the end of that 14-year cycle. So, and the whole time that this is going on, there are people suffering, right? There's a reason why there's research in these areas. And technology, we feel, can help. And if we could just reduce that cycle time by 1 year, that would make an enormous impact. I mean, I'm sure all of you know someone who might be benefiting from a solution that could come a year earlier that would have helped. So in our talk today, here's what we believe were the key factors of in our area, in a very highly regulated area, which made the biggest impact of implementing DevOps for us. And that was fostering a community, standing up a DevOps platform, improving, iterating on that platform, and then over-communicating. And it sounds really simple, but we learned a lot along the way, and we're going to share that with you here today. Starting with community.
Right. So as I might have mentioned earlier, we're here not to talk about the actual nuts and bolts tooling and what products we use and all that. It's all about the cultural change, which is actually a much bigger challenge, because when you're in this kind of environment, you've got very large legacy mindset, and you're trying to bring in new, fast-moving creative talent, and there's a natural tension. But in order to do it, you're also trying to respect the fact that you've got established systems that need to work well and need to continue to work well for those reasons I mentioned earlier. You could literally affect health. So first of all, what we did is you have to understand that we created a community from the bottom up throughout the IT and outside organizations. It wasn't mandated, it wasn't purchased, it wasn't done through an org chart. And then we had to establish really the genuine authoritative key players in that space, who understood their space, knew what worked well, had the right attitude to be open to changing how we work, and ultimately had the respect and decision rights to influence the right people to formally make the decisions to fund and do these sorts of things. We also had a model where within this community, it was very much like a scrum. When you're in a scrum, your badge number or your position doesn't really matter. Everyone is positioned to have an equal opinion to be considered, and there wasn't a hierarchy because I told you so. There was very much a listen to every person on what works well. There are key decision makers. There's a scrum master that manages the process so it doesn't get out of hand. And we ended up co-creating a plan around what we were going to do. Another key attribute here is we had to have this established before we put anything into production or anything into what resembled production. Because one of the things in our type of environment is that if they see a rogue system, if someone puts something in that doesn't appear to be supported correctly or does not appear to have the right artifacts, it's immediately a hard target. They don't know what they're doing, what's going on there. That may represent a lot of risk. And the tendency is to shoot it down and then ask questions. And that's for safety, in effect, for safety reasons. So you have to have everything in a row. You have the right people in a row. You have the right community in a row. And you have to anticipate what people are going to naysay about what you're doing and front run what those things might be. Because those people may actually have valuable insight on what's required. The other key actor here is in bold. The authoritative approvers. In our type of environment, people tend to build according to SOPs and policies and processes that were established, and at the end you get the quality inspection, and there's a compliance inspection, and it's all about how was it built correctly, are the artifacts there for support, are you sufficiently controlling what's being done? Is it sufficiently reproducible? Those sorts of things. And if you do it at the end, especially when you're introducing such a evasive change, if you're not totally in sync, and they're not totally in sync in what you've done and how you've built it, you're sort of dead on arrival. So what we had to do is actually involve these people untraditionally at the very beginning. They actually helped design, build how we do this, provided all the input on the intent of quality and compliance versus the SOPs, so we could actually rewrite them and make them fit the DevOps models. And at the end, they were our strongest advocates, because by the end, it was a moot point. We didn't need to really be inspected, per se. They, of course, did, but it was already done. They knew how it was built, and they could see the work that they were involved in. So you need to establish common cause now, and Jason can talk about that.
All right, great. So in the theme of community here, so and every company's culture is different. But I'll just talk you through what I like to do whenever I see two different mindsets appear that seem to be at odds with each other, and I'll go over those mindsets. So there's the traditionally regulated mindset on the left, and an innovation mindset on the right. And the traditionally regulated mindset would be very risk averse. I'll just build this out here. Focus on delivering the complete solution all at once. Have a lot of specializations, handoffs, and lock it down, right? And the agile is kind of the opposite of that. They want to, you want to try really fast and see what works, see what matches what people's expectations are, and iterate really quickly, offering continuous improvements. And at first, each of these mindsets were seemingly at odds with each other, because someone who's been around the company for a while, who's done things, maybe a little waterfall development, and going up, seeing these agile guys come in and going, oh, these guys, they're hazards. They're throwing caution to the wind. They're failing fast. Look at that. It says failure right there, right? And the agile people looking at the traditional regulated mindset people are going, oh, these guys are so slow. Man, if only I could get this through faster. There's so much overhead. I can't get anything through the pipe here. So when we burrowed down a little further, we realized, well, wait a minute. Both of these mindsets are incredibly laser-focused on the quality of the output. That is a key component that drives why each side is acting that way. All right, so let's keep asking why here. Peel this back a little further. So when we look at why here, we realize, oh, well, each side here is looking at decreasing failure. Well, one of the other benefits of working for a health science company is that when you bring data to the table or outside research to the table, people tend to give it a little more weight and will be more open-minded about it. And what's great about that is that if you saw the 2016 State of the DevOps report, there's all kinds of data now that shows that companies that release quicker, like multiple times per day, or top-performing companies, will fail three times less often when they deploy things. And when they do fail, then they recover 24 times faster. So there's real data to help kind of bridge this apparent gap here through this decreased failure assumption. Also, delivering the right product, and also increasing efficiency, and of course, increasing quality. So these are all common groundwork between these goals, and that really helped. But who's right here? Who should win, really? Well, that's really the wrong question. Let's think about this a little differently. What do each of these mindsets bring to the table? On the left side, traditional mindset, has a ton of experience being very successful at creating very high quality systems. And on the right side, with the DevOps kind of agile mindset, you have the skills that's necessary to thread that perfect storm that Pete mentioned earlier together and really harness the future. So really what you want, instead of thinking who wins, so you want to think, how can I integrate these two mindsets together so that they form a more powerful team? And success when you start seeing things like, so we have a hub in Prague that's fairly new. It's about 2 years old, and so everyone who works there is newly hired. So they don't have as much regulatory background on the first day, and they also tend to come from like startup cultures and startups. So they have a hackathon every year, at least for the past 2 years, and this year's hackathon, the top three winners all had to do with improvements to the SDLC process or the regulatory processes that go on. And right now there's some spin-up projects that are actually making improvements to that now, so and making it easier to adhere to the regulations that typically would make people balk. Right? All right, so that's a lot on community. Let's talk about the DevOps platform, actually. Pete? Mm-hmm.
So the key here when we say create a platform is very much around make sure you create a platform that's viable and respected, so to speak, trustable, and not under a desk and not with any loose threads or anything like that. Because once you create that, you're getting a lot of fear and doubt out of the system. So what you see here is sort of a mildly obscured view of our DevOps environment. It contains components that are pure DevOps and a lot of components that are legacy. It also can be used for waterfall, actually. And so it's an enhancement, and we're not saying that DevOps in our culture is a replacement for Agile. We're saying that it's another thing to be added as a capability. So we're not telling people we're taking away your Agile, we're taking away what you're doing. We're saying you have new options. So one thing we had to do is these are distinct groups in the different colors. We have an app dev group, which is the yellow. We have our service management test. We have what you would say traditional ops in a modern ops along the bottom pink and upper right. And then our release management process people in the green. These are all distinct groups who have been doing everything they do quite well in a regulatory environment, just not yet with DevOps. So what we first had to do was build the bridges around this is what you do well, here's what we're introducing, and we put it under an overarching program to take care of the icky things like procurement and finance. Because any one of these groups would say, I want to be like DevOps, and they would not necessarily get the support in their own little organization, not little, but. And we had to also thread things between these groups and provide architecture support to make sure it was done correctly and at scale using the core people underneath. And what's interesting is the technology pieces were a challenge and actually very, people embraced them. It was really fun to work on. But the other program-related things also started to come up, which were significant in a large company. So, for example, procurement, what's the big deal? Well, we have a fine-tuned ops organization, a few thousand people that do it incredibly well. They can provision people and things and services, on a dime. But we introduced, wait a minute, we want to introduce people that also are participating in DevOps that do app work, dev work, and pretty much touch all pieces of these areas. Procurement blew a gasket because that doesn't fit their standard descriptions. It doesn't fit their rate cards. How do you hire for that? How do these groups interview for that? If release management wants to bring a DevOps engineer, where do you interview them, right? And that sort of makes HR a little, we had to start educating and working with those areas to make it smooth to even execute once you're up and running DevOps. And there were a lot of hidden things like procurement and finance, for example, that came to light. So what was our common goal? We said amongst us all as a program, we want to make a successful trip on a fully qualified system for an application around the entire DevOps infinity loop, if you've seen that, the loop. And that was our common goal. And what that meant is everything was qualified, validated, the help desk, support, command center, everything ops, but also all the rigor around application development in our environment. And that was our common goal. And once again, by creating those lines, we're creating new paths of process. DevOps is that path. That meant compliance needed to understand and provide enough support for audit and other things and approve the quality and auditability of this environment. So they were involved in the design of those lines from day one and ultimately approved them when we went live. Okay. So moving forward.
Mm-hmm. So now we'll talk about the improvement strategy here.
Okay. So another thing in retrospect that we believe we did well was rather than do a top-down procurement, RFP type of process and big bang, design the whole thing to the very end, is we actually applied agile thinking to this. And what we did was we looked around our organization before we started to locate where there were deer paths. I don't know if you know the analogy of, you look where the deer paths are and where the deer have figured out the best place to go to stay alive and thrive, you pave those paths and make them formal. So we basically queried our environment, measured our environment, and figured out where people were doing code development. We went out to GitHub and saw where people were using that, for example. We looked where people were using our internal tools and getting them to work in a partial DevOps way. And we did a crawl, walk, run. So we started to rope in the good things that were in place and getting the rigor around them. And we brought in the collaboration tools that would enable the teams to work and the community to thrive. And then rather than go for a fully qualified environment, we went for a partially qualified, which means we could not work necessarily on regulated repositories, but we could work on everything else as a stepping stone. And get that up and get people around the loop and then heavily communicate what that meant.
And what's nice is you can measure these things, and this is just basic usage metrics, and we've been working on this for about 2 years, and since then you've seen rapid adoption across the IT organization at Merck. And just to give you some context, so Confluence has 3,300 active users in 1 month. There's 5,000 IT employees worldwide at Merck. So that's huge adoption, but that's only part of the story.
Right. So our company has been transforming to a platform-based API ecosystem around our services, shared services, microservices, to sort of model what's happening outside of Merck. People are writing apps that basically leverage platforms on the internet and data sources that are all over the place to build composite, what we call mashup apps, to do interesting things. And we've put in an API management tier that lets us catalog and start chipping away at providing a consistent front end, or at least a consistent catalog of APIs that people can look up, use, publish to, and then have people consume. Our adoption rate, and DevOps obviously fuels the code that writes, that people are writing apps and consuming the APIs. So you can see over 2 or so years, our API consumption is definitely trending high and fast. And we're also getting to see the reuse counts, and we can actually start talking to people outside IT around, we've published capabilities, people are actually reusing these APIs and actually driving cost and putting reliability and consistency into the system, which actually the quality people love, because if you've qualified a set of APIs and 5 different teams are using them, there's not 5 unknown things running there. There's one that got qualified, and the rest come along for the ride. I'll talk about the first one. Some of these apps that we're talking about have had side effects, meaning the tooling itself has enabled us to take the DevOps view of, for example, our Jira backlogs and tie them into our portfolio and our financial tracking. This was unheard of. People heard we were starting to do this, and they got really excited, and they go, really, are you serious? What we're able to do is actually from authoritative sources, not people submitting status reports, but actually we can look at code backlogs on the various projects, look at their milestones, develop real-time dashboards, and actually say, you've spent half of your money, but you're two-thirds through your milestones. Or conversely, your project's not accelerating very much, but your budget is. It also, when someone can come in and say, on the consumption side, are people actually using the apps and features that you've asked to build and that you've built? That kind of insight is hard to get in a large waterfall environment that we have on the legacy side. We're hoping to have this inform that legacy side and also use this as a model moving forward that we're developing with.
Right. Yeah, and what's great about this is that one of the most powerful things you can do when trying anything new is show success, right? So in 2 major areas, there's 2 apps here, a sales app and a clinical trials app that were developed either an MVP in 2 months or a first rev of it in 6 months. They're much faster than before and with no shortcuts, with all the regulatory rigor that goes into those things and in the regulatory space. So, and it's touching systems that are like really, really important systems that historically were really difficult to get access to. But with the API strategy that Pete alluded to, it actually becomes easier and quicker, and we're showing that velocity as well here.
Right, so I would just chime in that the big sort of tip when you go from partial regulatory to regulatory is the data you're allowed to work with, right? So research works on regulated data, things that the government watches and things that need to be handled very carefully, clinical trial data, patient data or patient cohort data. Unless you have validated, regulated tools, you can't touch them. So the opportunity is for a clinical researcher, we can't build an app like that. We're not allowed to, effectively, unless we're working with systems, you know, software development systems and deployment systems that are validated to and allowed to do so. So we've opened the door up on a whole universe of possible apps for innovation and insight that wasn't there before through the use of DevOps.
Great. So now we've talked a lot about iteration and improving, but let's talk now about over-communicating. I won't go into too much detail here, but basically the lesson here is if you think you're communicating enough, you're not communicating enough. There's always room for more. And Pete and I have been talking and shouting from the hills, the hilltops at Merck for like 2 years now about what we're doing, and also partnering with our communications group inside the company, who's been really super helpful in getting that message out. So we thought everybody knows what we're working on, you know? And then it turns out there's some pockets that just, I think it was a couple of months ago, one of our sites in Singapore started spinning up their own DevOps stack. And they're like, oh, we need to start this up. And luckily we found it early, and we're like, oh, did you know we had this whole stack up over here? And they were relieved. They were like, oh, great, we'll use yours. So the lesson here is that, you know, not everyone hears everything, so keep communicating and over-communicate if possible. And in the spirit of over-communicating, here are the four key strategies that we talked about today. So we talked about building a community, fostering a community, building our DevOps platform, iterating and improving, and finally, over-communication. And we always remember why this is important, because 14 years is just too long. If we can discover things faster and enable improving lives faster, that would be a huge impact, because healthcare affects everybody. And we hope that we can apply this technology to help drive improvements and make a real difference in people's lives. So, thank you. I think we have some time for questions now, right? I would just remind everyone, if you do have
there's
a question,
a microphone
you got to use
in the middle there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so one thing I was interested in is if any of your regulatory constraints affected how you had to set up, like things like HIPAA, and like, did it affect how you designed your stacks, and did you have limitations that were really impacting because of that?
I have to frame it in an indirect way, right? So the processes that make you, for example, GXP ready, are you familiar with GXP? So the GXP process is the process or the set of processes that prove and demonstrate that you're handling that type of data safely with control, you know, HIPAA. And by the way, you know, generally speaking, we don't have patient data. I mean, we deal with cohorts. And by making these systems rock solid GXP ready, by side effect or effect, you actually have the processes in place to show and demonstrate those controls, and also for other types of data. So that's the mechanism that we achieve, we address the concerns, and GXP is the path or the accepted procedure by regulatory agencies and others that we can demonstrate that we're handling things safely. So we do GXP to provide the protections you're talking about. But is it exceptional? Well, that's the point. That's why we're doing it. Does that make sense? Okay.
We can talk more.
Find me afterwards. I'll explain it.
Hey, guys. Jake Levin. I work for Bayer, so I'm in the same space as you guys.
Cool.
What was the biggest hurdle you found with getting legacy IT to adopt this? And did you have a lot of pushback? Did you have to bring in fresh people with fresh ideas?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And how did you get security and risk management on board?
All good questions.
Yeah, so Jason mentioned we recently redistributed our technology organizations across the U.S. to spread across the U.S., Prague, and Singapore. And Prague was a brand new greenfield. And a lot of the talent that came in was, as Jason mentioned, startups, some people worked for places like Airbus and other regulated, and they actually understood. And there was that, you know, why do we have to do it this way? And, oh, look, I went ahead and did this, and people's hair would go up and go, well, you just can't do that. You have to understand the steps that go through. So there was this initial tough but worth it dialogue. It's culture. We literally had to make friends, understand where they're coming from, and that sounds kitschy, but it was very serious. There was ups and downs, and over time, we got to that common ground. We all started realizing that we weren't that far apart, and I call that two columns of the legacy and the new as sort of the mutual respect slide, because the one thing was, in a weird way, just culturally, in effect, you don't know what you're doing, you're too slow, you don't know what you're doing, you're too fast. The minute people over time started understanding, if you don't do it right, you could actually cause damage. And by the way, we can move fast, just follow it with the, here's a really cooperative compliance person who understands, get down to the intent of what we want to do, and they were eager to understand what they needed to do to fit, you know, to make their stuff work. And when we jumped over that barrier from the tension to please tell me how to move. I want to move fast. I know how to move fast. You know the environment. Help me. And having the quality people be that catalyst, that was the thing. You know, that was the secret sauce. And I would never have expected that going in, but then it just became very apparent. And the culture was the hardest thing. Technology was relatively, I won't say easy, it was straightforward. And second?
Oh, and the security team. The other thing is to also be sure to be as inclusive as possible in your DevOps teams, like include security in those teams. Maybe not even a dedicated person, but at least someone you know you can go to help contribute right. to that scrum.
I mean, our compliance and regulatory work sort of hand in hand. They all know each other. They all talk together. They all flag things to each other, and we all know them now. I mean, we're all sort of meshed in. There's also the fail fast, which is, we promoted an environment, especially with our newer colleagues, to this environment that, you know, something weird, something doesn't make sense, go ask. And we had to make sure there wasn't a stonewall, a lack of response, or a automatic no. We actually went in, our group especially, would go in and say, okay, start with yes and how. Let's just clarify the methodology or, you know, if there's a concern, what it really is. And the adversarial aspect got deflated. And I mean, that was genuinely the heart. We spent most of our time getting a beer, pulling people together, getting people on the same page, and by example, showing people didn't get hurt if things weren't perfect and we were working through them.
Right. Yeah. So prove out your successes and then
right.
show them and not be afraid of them. That's good.
This is a culture talk. And you know,
that's good.
Actually, this is really cultural.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Michael Dunlap from Yale University IT.
Hi.
So you implemented a document wiki, you know, your Confluence for collaboration.
Yep.
I'm assuming that you already had knowledge repositories before that. What did you do to encourage people to stop using the old knowledge repositories in favor of a new collaboration space?
We did not do that. We didn't say we did that. We're adding capabilities. We're not right. displacing, right? In most life science companies, especially knowledge management repositories where you hold research information, informal information, are really, in effect, highly protected crown jewels, right? In fact, some parts of our knowledge management systems literally go to audits and are the system of record for, you know, how a drug was built, for example, or what a clinical trial did. So what we did do is create a fit-for-use document/socialization communication around what each, the Confluence, in our case, SharePoint, and First Doc Midas, what they were appropriate for, what you had to, you know, those, you must use this for this because of regulatory, but in these spaces, these are valid, and it might be the answer more than one's okay. and had very clear guidelines, and we actually have to implement automation to ensure the right things go in the right place. It wasn't a move on. In fact, if we went in and said with any of this, we're taking away that and we're putting in our stuff, it would have fallen on its face.
Yeah. Just added it. Yeah.
Thank you. That was a really good question.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it looks like we're... 2 minutes?
Sure.
Oh, 2 minutes. Okay.
Sure.
Are there any more questions?
Very good questions. You sort of hit... you hit our nerves, which is actually really good. You hit things that were actually significant to us. So we're interested in anyone else on this journey, and we're a very collaborative group, and we're surprisingly open, people say. You can find our contact information somewhere in our collateral. We'd love to continue the conversation either here or even outside, you know, just to stay in touch and trade notes. It's an interesting journey, and I think everyone, you know, we can learn from anyone we work with and we share. So thank you very much.
Thank you.